How firm a foundation, ye saints of the Lord, is laid for your faith in His excellent word. What more can He say than to you He has said, who unto the Savior for refuge have fled? Who unto the Savior for refuge have fled. The soul that on Jesus hath leaned for repose, I will not desert to his foes. That soul, though all hell shall endeavor to shake, I'll never, no, never, no, never forsake. I'll never, no, never, no, never forsake.
Would you turn your Bibles to Genesis 32? We're continuing our study of the patriarch Jacob, and that song certainly reflects what we learn in the lesson today, that soul, though all hell should endeavor to shake, I'll never, no, never, no, never forsake. Now, the last time we discussed Genesis 29 to 31, and the title of that message was Faith Disciplined by Reality. And we saw that Jacob was tested time after time in those three chapters. And we were impressed by the way he handled those tests. You know, I was a teacher at one time, and I gave tests, and my perception of those tests was altogether different from the student's perception. The student's perception of those tests was that somehow I was trying to get them to do badly. I think that's what some of them thought. Actually, that wasn't my purpose at all. My purpose was to motivate them to study hard and to learn and to grow in their understanding and to make progress. That's from my perspective. Teachers, at least good teachers, I hope I was a good teacher, never give tests to fail people. And they don't want people to fail. In fact, the students would only have known how grieved I was and frustrated with my failure as a teacher when they failed my test. They probably would have gained a better perspective on what those tests were all about. Well, it's the same way with God. God gives us tests. He never gives us tests to show up our weakness, except to show it up to us so that we know how much we depend upon Him. But He's not trying to get anything over on anybody. He wants through those tests to make us strong. He suits the test to what He knows we can handle. And He leads us along in our growth by those tests. And so we saw that Joseph had the test of disappointed devotion. He ended up not marrying originally the woman that he wanted. He ended up with actually four wives and all kinds of marital trouble when he only wanted one wife. But we noticed that he handled that well. He did about as equitably as anybody could have done in that situation toward all the women involved, and actually did not rebel, did not take it out on Leah, which he could have done, and could have shown her that he really didn't want her, and that could have been something she'd have had to endure all her life. We have no record whatsoever that he did any such thing. Then we had the discipline of deceitful dealings. Laban definitely wanted everything in his favor. And remember, when it really came down to it, Jacob said in his negotiation with Laban, I don't want anything. And he left it pretty much totally up to God, and God prospered him. So he handled that well. He did not respond to Laban in kind by trying to deceive him. And then we had the discipline of difficult disengagement, the way he handled his leaving of his father-in-law, and the way he was so quick and ready to forgive. And there's where we are at the end of chapter 31. When Laban shows a conciliatory tone, Jacob immediately picks up on it, is not one bit interested in talking about past wrongs, although he does tell him about all of those, but he lets those go, and he's willing to make peace with his father-in-law and responds wholeheartedly to that. And then in the end, of course, worships God, offers the first sacrifice that he ever offered in verse 54, and parted peaceably with Laban. And so that's the setting that we're moving from into chapter 32. And in this chapter, it says that Jacob went on his way. I like that. He was in a good way. He was in a position of total dependence upon God. He was at peace with Laban. You know, Jacob had two great enemies. One of them was Laban, if you want to call him an enemy, an opponent. And then, of course, he had Esau. Now, the one had been taken care of, and now he's going to meet the one, actually, that is the most threatening, and that is Esau. And I think God brought him through the trial with Laban to prepare him for the next one. And he was in a good way. You remember that servant of Abraham's where it says, he being in the way, God led him. Well, you know, God can do all kinds of things that he wants to do when he finds us in the right way. And Jacob is in the right way. He's on the way, having made peace with Laban. Everything's fine. Heaven's open. And he's ready to go. All right? God leads us as we are in the way. But Jacob knew that he was very helpless. Here he was traveling. He obviously could not amass a large army with all the cattle and all the stuff that he had. He only had a few servants. And he knew that Esau would likely be able to come against him with a lot of people and readily armed. Esau was not traveling. He didn't have to carry a lot of stuff with him. He could just take his soldiers and come. And so he knew that he probably was really going to be up against it with Esau. And Esau could easily have destroyed him. So, it says here that God's angels met him. And let's just read a few verses here. And Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's host." And he called the name of that place Mahanaim, which means two hosts. And so Jacob was very encouraged because all of a sudden he realized that his little host, if that's how you want to look at it, was basically reinforced by the armies of heaven. And he saw that these two hosts were going to be able to handle whatever came. I sang that song we sang for a purpose. That last verse says, "The soul that on Jesus hath leaned for repose, I will not desert to his foes." That soul, though, and that's two, I will not desert to his foes. That soul, though all hell should endeavor to shake, I'll never, no, never, no, never forsake. And if you look at Hebrews chapter 13, verses 5 and 6, you have that fivefold assurance in the verse. I'll read it to you from the Amplified. He, God, himself has said, "I will not in any way fail you, nor give you up, nor leave you without support. I will not in any degree leave you helpless, nor forsake you, nor let you down, relax my hold on you, assuredly not." So the hymn writer knew this fivefold assurance in Hebrews 13, verses 5 and 6, and he wrote that in that song. That's why we sang it. Maybe at the end of the message we'll sing that song again. But anyway, Jacob had to be reassured, again, like God reassured him at other times, that he was not alone. Remember that time when he was there and saw that ladder and saw that all of heaven was interested in little Jacob and his problems. And so God comes along and reassures him again and opens his eyes, I think, really, to see the angels that are there all the time. God's mighty angels, it says in 1 Thessalonians 1, verse 7, I think it is. It talks about the mighty angels of God. And the Bible makes it very clear that they're with us. They're here to minister to us. We just can't see them, but they're there. And so God shows them to Jacob. And Jacob, of course, is greatly encouraged by seeing that. Hebrews 13, verses 5 and 6 ends that little passage by saying, "So that we may boldly say..." And that's why God showed them to Jacob at this point, because Jacob needed that boldness. "So that we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, I will not fear what man shall do unto me." And we should be able to say that in the most threatening circumstances, based on what we know about God's help and protection and the angels around us. But anyway, he showed them to Jacob. All right? And then Jacob encouraged by that. He sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, into the land of Seir, the country of Edom. That's where Esau finally ended up. Seir was a Horite chief that had ruled the place and was dispossessed, apparently, by Esau's people. And he commanded them, saying, in verse 4, "Thus shall you speak unto my lord Esau." Now, that's interesting how he says that. You know, one of the reasons Esau was so angry with Jacob was because Jacob was trying to take the upper hand with the birthright and then finally took away his blessing. And so he saw Jacob as a political threat. He saw Jacob as a person who was a threat to his material blessings. And you notice here that Jacob, when he sends the messengers to Esau, he wants to make it very clear to Esau that he is not going to try to dominate Esau. That's in the past. And furthermore, he doesn't want any of Esau's possessions. Esau can have all the possessions he has. He has what he needs. And so I just want you to notice here, twice he calls him Lord. Jacob's in an altogether different frame of mind here than he was when he left Esau 20 years earlier. And he wanted Esau to know that. He wanted Esau to know, I think, that he had found in God all that he needed. And he didn't need to connive. And he didn't need to manipulate and dominate other people. And so he says to him, "Thus shall you speak to my lord Esau, thy servant Jacob saith thus, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now, and I have oxen and asses and flocks and manservants and woman servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I am my lord," see? And they were to say that to Esau, "that I may find grace in thy sight." And the messengers returned to Jacob. I don't even know if they met Esau. The picture I have is that they saw him coming and they tried to estimate the size of his group of men, and he had 400 men, and it looked threatening to them, and they scurried back to Jacob to tell him this. I don't know if they had a chance to talk. Apparently they had no chance to talk to Esau. Of course, we don't know what was in Esau's heart. It could be he was coming with the 400 men to impress Jacob with how great he was, whatever that would have accomplished. Or maybe he was coming with the 400 men to get revenge. Or maybe he was coming with the 400 men simply to protect himself because he thought Jacob was going to come and try to take him by force or overcome him. I mean, it could have been one of those three or all of those three possibilities in Esau's mind. We don't know. But it seems as though Esau had no opportunity to convey his intentions to Jacob, because we don't get any real intentions here. We just find out that these men are coming. And of course, Jacob believes the worst. And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to thy brother Esau, and he cometh to meet thee, and 400 men with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. Isn't that just so human? He just has seen this host of angels, and God has reassured him. In fact, God, back at Bethel, when he was there, had told him, "I'll bring you again to this land. I'm going to take care of you." And when he told him to leave Laban and come back to the land, he says, "I'll be with you and I'll meet all your needs." And now the angels are here. It just shows Jacob's just like us. We can know all the things we discussed in our Sunday school lesson this morning, and every one of them is true. And tomorrow morning, we can face something and we can fall flat on our faces. But God knows how to deal with that. That's the thing that blesses me. God never scolds Jacob for his lack of faith. He never does anything negative toward Jacob. He just keeps leading him along and helping him to strengthen his faith and to overcome. That's such a blessing to me. All right, anyway, and Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that was with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two bands. And this was a very common tactic, that if a caravan was traveling and it looked like they were going to be attacked, they divided into two bands, then the one would be attacked and the other one could escape. And so that's what he did. If Esau come to one company and smite it, then the other company, which is left, shall escape. And so he did all he could do, and then he prayed. And I think that was appropriate. I think we should do all that we can do, with the idea that God will have to make the difference then. After we've done all we can do, God will take care of the rest. So, we want to talk to this morning about Jacob's experience with the blessing of God. And the title of the message this morning is, "Don't Miss the Blessing." Don't miss the blessing. Now, the reason I say that is because Esau, of course, lost the blessing. And we're gonna end the discussion with a little bit about Esau. In fact, the longest chapter is chapter 36. I'm going to assure you that my comments on that will be about 5 minutes, probably at the most. So when we get down to that part, don't start to panic that we're going to discuss that whole chapter in detail. We're not going to. I'm just going to make a few comments about it. Anyway, so Esau was without blessing. And Jacob lost it occasionally. And when you lose the blessing, when you step out of the place of blessing, it gets pretty bad. But God gets him, of course, back into the place of blessing. So we have this thing of blessing and not being blessed. The person who's in the place of blessing, whether it's Esau permanently out of it, or Jacob who loses it occasionally, and then what it looks like when you're in the place of blessing. And so the title of the message this morning is Don't Lose, Don't Miss the Blessing. And so I'll put my outline on the board. Okay. One. The blessing sought. Okay, and that's 32. 1, 2, 32. And then we have the blessing received. And that's 33, 1 to 16. And then we have the blessing forfeited. And that's 33, 17 to 34, 31. And then we have the blessing restored. Isn't that wonderful? You know, the psalmist says, He restoreth my soul. And that just struck me recently. It's obvious that there were times when the psalmist got himself in real trouble and the Lord restored him. I mean, there's always that restoration. And that's a real blessing. 35, 1 to 29. And then the last one is about Esau, the blessing diverted. 36, 1 to 43. Okay. Let's talk about the blessing sought. We have here the first recorded prayer of supplication in the whole Bible. I mean, there's instances where there was communication between God and Abraham and God and Isaac and God and Jacob before this. But this is the first time we actually have a recorded prayer of supplication. And it's a beautiful prayer. It's a very beautiful prayer. And Jacob said, and in fact, if you read down through these chapters, you will be impressed, again, like we were the other time, of the many references of Jacob's dependence upon God. I must admit, this study has given me an altogether different view than I would have had previously of Jacob. We see his faults if we're not careful. We do not see what we're seeing here laced through the whole account in an unusual way. And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac. So he was affirming the fact that God had had dealings with those two people and that he believed in those dealings. The Lord which saidest unto me, return unto thy country and to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. In fact, the Lord had actually repeated that promise twice when he called Jacob from Laban. And so he's telling the Lord, he says, you know, here I am. I don't know what's going to happen, but you did promise that you would deal well with me. And of course, we're always on good footing with the Lord when we remind him of the promises he's made and affirm our belief in those promises. And that's what he's doing. And then he says, look at the humility here. I'm not worthy of the least of all thy mercies, and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant, for with my staff, that's all I had in my hand when I passed over this Jordan, I only had this rod. And now, I'm become two bands. Deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he will come and smite me, and the mother with the children. And here it is, again. And thou saidest, I will surely do thee good, and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. And so, he's reminding God, and he's affirming his belief. You know, we have this struggle. We believe, and yet there's Esau. And I was just encouraged at his humanity here in the light of what all God had revealed to him and what all he believed. He still struggled at the same level that we struggle. But anyway, so the next thing he did was he decides to send a gift to Esau. Now, trusting in God does not mean we don't do anything. I mean, these are very wise things that he did. I mean, it's, you know, God blesses the type of action he took next. The next action he took was to demonstrate to Esau his heart toward him. And that, I don't think this was a bribe. I think this was a genuine offer of generosity to his brother to communicate to him how he really did feel toward him. And the gift here is incredible. It's 580 animals. That gives you some sense of how wealthy this man was. And it says he just took what came to his hand. He didn't have a lot of time to go and organize this. He just sort of took some animals here and animals there. And the impression is there were a lot more left after the 580. But that's a lot of animals. And he sent them in five separate droves. The animals he had were goats, sheep, cattle, camels, and asses or donkeys. And what he did was he put a drove of goats with the caretaker. And the goats were to go before, and Esau was to see the goats, and then the caretaker would come along and give this message that he was supposed to give. This is from Jacob. And he wishes you well, and he wants to be at peace with you. And then next would come a drove of sheep, and the same message. And then would come a drove of cattle, and the same message. And then a drove of camels, and the same message. And then a drove of donkeys, and the same message. It would have been a little bit hard for Esau not to get the point, or to believe the generosity of this man. All right. He's showing to Esau that old heel catcher that was always out to get something for himself, or at least in those cases where Esau felt taken advantage of, that he had totally changed. And instead of a taker, he was now a giver. You know, it's interesting that the first evidence of salvation given by the apostle, John the Baptist, when they said, "What shall we do?" Those of us who want to show repentance, John says, "Give two coats. If you have two coats, give one away. If you have extra..." When there's a change of heart, it changes from being this to this. And Jacob had made that change. All right? So after he had sent these animals to communicate that to Esau, he's camped by the river Jabbok. I want you to sort of picture how this was. Here's the Sea of Galilee, and here's the Dead Sea, and the Jordan River. And the Jabbok runs here just almost a little bit south of the middle. Whoop. My mind says one thing and my hand does something else. No, that's not right either. Okay. And the word Jabbok means wrestler. So I think this river was probably named. It's actually a wadi. I'm not sure there's actually a river there. I think it's a river when it rains. It was probably named later because of what happened there. But anyway, that's where he was. And he was coming from the north. And Esau, of course, would be coming from the south. Seir was down here. And that's where they were going to meet. And so he puts his family over the river. And then he apparently goes back. In other words, he wants them over the river so he doesn't have that to worry with when he meets Esau. They'll all be over. And it also demonstrates to Esau that he has no plans to retreat. You know, they're going to cross the river, crossing the Rubicon, like they say. And then he apparently went back or stayed there, sent them across the river, and he was there by himself. And there he meets a man. And I want to just read this, and we'll talk about it as we read it. And he rose up that night and took his two wives and his two women servants and his 11 sons and passed over the ford Jabbok. And I've already told you what he did. He put them there. And sent over that he had. And Jacob was left alone. And there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. Now we find out that this man, he said that when he saw this man's face, he had seen the face of God. So it's almost certain here In fact, you know, they talk about him wrestling with an angel. Now, maybe I didn't read it carefully, and I'm good at overlooking things. If you find angel in here, you tell me after the service. But I'm not sure that the word angel is there at all. I don't know where that comes from. I think it comes from later. I think some later writer talks about him wrestling with an angel. But it doesn't say that here. It says it was a man, and he said after it was all over, he was wrestling with God, because he said, I've seen God face to face, and I have lived. So it seems to me it's a pretty good indication. It was a pre-incarnation appearance that he was actually wrestling with Jesus himself. And so anyway, he wrestled until the breaking of the day. And here was Jacob's old instinct. If something came against him, and it's the instinct of all of us, is to resist. And so, of course, it was God. And so he resisted and resisted. And God was merciful to him. He could have taken care of this before the night was over. But he let Jacob resist and resist. And as Jacob was resisting, all of a sudden he realized that it was God that he was resisting. And when he realized it was God, then he didn't resist anymore. He hung on. And he said, I want a blessing. You're the only person who can bless me. Now that I know who it is, I'm not resisting anymore. I'm hanging on because I want a blessing. Let's read it. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, let me go, for the day breaketh. And he said, I won't let you go except thou bless me. And he said unto him, what is thy name? Well, we know what his name was. His name was supplanter, heel catcher, deceiver, however you want to define Jacob. And so he's basically doing what he does to all of us. Are you willing to be realistic about who you really are? And Jacob, he was. Jacob said, in essence, in his language, my name is deceiver. My name is supplanter. And he said, there's going to be a change. Because you are so desperately involved personally with me, and you're willing to admit who you are, and you're willing to let me, and you want a blessing from me, thy name shall be no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince hast thou power with God. And that's what Jacob, Israel means. It means one who fights victoriously with God. That's a tremendous concept. I mean, Jacob before, his relationship with God had been based on promises and directions that God had given him. But his relationship with God from now on was going to be one of an intimate union with God himself. And when I was reading this morning and studying this, I was thinking how desperately we need that. You know, a lot of people are sort of operating on some promises. They like those. And a few even can handle some of God's commandments. But how many of us are really wanting a personal involvement with God? Like Abraham had, and like Jacob now has. Anyway, this is sort of an interesting wrestling match. After Jacob is down, God puts his thigh out of joint. Then God says to him, now you won. That's interesting. When God finally has us conquered, then he says, you won. You won. We win when we're finally conquered. I ask you this morning, have you been conquered? Has God been able to conquer you? The minute he is able to conquer, he says, you won. You're a winner. All right, let's continue reading. It's just a tremendous passage. As a prince, thou hast power with God and with men. That was the reassurance he needed. That he was going to have power with Esau. And Jacob asked him and said, tell me, I pray thee, thy name. You ask me my name, what's your name? And he responds with a rhetorical question, wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name? You already know who I am. And Jacob proves in just a moment that he does. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for he said, I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. And as he passed over Penuel, the sun rose upon him, and he halted upon his thigh. And just so he didn't wake up the next morning and say, well, that was maybe a nightmare, he had a thigh that was damaged for the rest of his life, that he could remember this was a real encounter with God. This was not a nightmare. This was not a dream. This was a physical encounter with God himself. And let me read it here. Therefore the children of Israel eat not of the sinew which shrank, which is upon the hollow of the thigh unto this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh and the sinew that shrank. Okay. So Jacob leaves this place with a broken attitude toward himself, a new name, and a blessing. And, you know, I sometimes think we are too quick to leave the place of communion with God. I think God delights in having us have this kind of desperation for His blessing. You know, there was another place in the Bible where some people said to God, if you don't bless us, we're not interested in going. I mean, God's blessing is that important. And I ask you this morning, are you in the place of blessing? All right, now we want to talk about the blessing received. he's still, after all that, he still is a human being struggling. And that's, I guess, if I don't get anything across this morning, that's what I want to get across. We are human beings, and just like Jacob. Here the angels came to, he saw these angels meeting him. He has this tremendous encounter with God. He has promises to base his trust in. God says, you prevail with me and with men. He has that. He has all this now, and Jacob is still struggling. He's still struggling. All right, so what happened here? Well, he puts the family in groups so that the ones he loves the most will be protected the most. Now, this is not cowardice, because you're going to find out he went in front of all of them. But he puts the handmaidens with their children, then he puts Leah with her children, and then he puts Rachel with Joseph. And then he goes ahead. And look what he does. Verse 3. I mean, this is a different Jacob than what we saw 20 years before this. And he passed over before them and bowed himself to the ground 7 times. Now, I'm told that that's exactly what you did when you came into the presence of a king. Some of the ancient records record this type of obeisance when somebody came into the presence of a king. So he goes in front of them and he bows down 7 times. So Esau gets the point that he really does regard him as his master, and that Esau has nothing to fear from him. Verse 4. Like I said, I don't know what was in Esau's heart. I don't know if he was bringing those 400 men to impress Jacob. I don't know if he was bringing those 400 men to get revenge on Jacob. I don't know if he was bringing those 400 men just to protect himself. I don't know what it was. But whatever it was, his love for his brother all of a sudden overcame him. And I think this was a work of God. I think God did what he did to Laban. Remember Laban? God spoke to him in the night and said, don't speak to Jacob for good or for bad. And that's what happened here. God spoke to this man, or dealt with this man, and put a love in his heart. And that blesses me. You know, when we get things right with God, and when we have things right with other people like he had with Laban, then God does intervene like he did here. And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the women and children. He said, who are these? And he said, these are the women, children, which the Lord has graciously given to thy servant. And then he had them all come, the handmaidens' children, and they courteously introduced themselves to Esau. And then Leah came with her children, and then Joseph and Rachel came. And then he says, what meanest thou by all this drove which I met? And he said, these are to find grace in the sight of my Lord. See, there it is again. I mean, he's trying to communicate that things are different now. And Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep that thou hast unto thyself. And Jacob said, nay, I pray thee, if now I have found grace in thy sight, then receive my present at my hand, for therefore have I have seen thy face as though I had seen the face of God, and thou wast pleased with me. He saw God in the face of his brother. Isn't that, that's a significant statement. Take, I pray thee, my blessing. Ah, so you share the blessing now that is brought to thee, because God has dealt gracious with me, and because I have enough. It's interesting that the Hebrew word here is different. Esau says, I have enough, I have much. And Jacob says, I have enough. Well, the Hebrew word that Esau uses is I have much. The Hebrew word that Jacob uses is I have everything. I like that. And even though probably Esau had material possessions, and we find in chapter 36 that Esau's family multiplied much faster than Jacob's. And he conquered the land of Edom. And there were 14 dukes. I mean, he was, and this was at a time when Jacob didn't have even almost any land at all. And they were still sojourners in the land. And that didn't bother Jacob any. He says, I have everything. The earth is the Lord's. The meek shall inherit the earth. That was his perception. He said to Esau, I don't need anything. Yes, you have a lot, but I have everything. That just really blessed me. Okay, so anyway, he presses his brother, and his brother finally takes the gift. And that satisfied Jacob that the peace was ratified then between them. And so now Esau said, well, let's go. Now, I think what happens next here is that Jacob had learned by hard experience not to get involved with people who were not in the place of blessing. He'd learned that with Laban. And he learned how difficult it was to extricate himself from that situation. And even though he loved his brother Esau, and even though he had peace with his brother Esau now, he didn't want to get involved with Esau. And so he very tactfully tells him that, we can't travel as fast as you want to travel. Your men will want to get home, and we'll drive the herds too fast, and they'll die, and we have mothers and children here. We want to go slowly. We won't travel together. And then Esau says, well, at least let me give you some of my men to protect you. And Jacob said, no, we don't need that either. And I think Jacob was realizing that if he was to be in the place of blessing, he had to keep that line of separation between him and Esau. Would that he had remembered that. Would that he had remembered that. We come to the next part, the blessing forfeited. I want you to notice what it says in verse 18. And Jacob came, I'm sorry, we want to start with verse 16. So Esau returned that day on his way unto Seir. And Jacob journeyed to Succoth, which means booths. I think that was named later. And built him a house and made booths for his cattle. Therefore, the name of the place is called Succoth. Now, Succoth is on this map, is right here. And so they pretty well stayed exactly where they were. I think by this time they were tired. They had just been through tremendous trauma. And so they decide to rest. I think they end up resting longer than what maybe they had planned to, because Jacob actually built himself a house and they built booths for the cattle. And it looks to me like they spent a considerable amount of time there at Succoth. Well, then after that, Jacob came to Shalom, a city of Shechem. I think what it means there is he came to the city of Shechem in peace, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Padan Aram and pitched his tent before the city, and he bought a parcel of the field, of a field, where he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money, and he erected an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. Where was Jacob supposed to go? Where had he told the Lord he would go if the Lord blessed him and took care of him? Bethel. Okay? Here is Shechem. Here is Bethel. And I might as well just say down here is Hebron, where his father Isaac is. Now, I'm not going to fault him for going over here, because it was sort of the way to go. But my question is, why did he stay at Shechem? Why did he buy a piece of ground there? He apparently stayed there for some almost 10 years. He stayed there for a long time. He had promised the Lord that if the Lord took care of him, he would come back and the house of God would be at Bethel. There's no mention here that God directed him to stay here. Now, we have clear direction in chapter 35 that he was to go to Bethel. Also, we have pretty good evidence that he went down here to Hebron to visit his father on occasion, because we find out later that he had his mother's nurse, who was Deborah, and so she's with them in this journey, so apparently he must have visited down here. And he'd had to pass Bethel on the way. And yet we have absolutely no record of Jacob going to Bethel. He settled here. It almost seems like he avoided Bethel. I don't know why. It's inexplicable to me. But we find out that his experience at Shechem was not blessed. And that's why we're talking about he forfeited the blessing. I'm reading between the lines here, I must admit. But with all the events put together that you observe here now of what happened, it's pretty obvious to me that he wasn't really where he should have been. He was in heathen territory. He wasn't where God had, where he said he was going to be. He wasn't at the place of blessing, which was Bethel. And when he finally got there, he was blessed. So it seems as though for some reason, I don't know if he was perhaps a little overconfident. You know, he had just had a tremendous encounter with God. He had just had an incredible reconciliation with his brother. And he'd been promised all these blessings and so on. Maybe he thought, well, you know, these people are heathen. I'll settle there. And it actually is one of the nicer places in the land. A good place to graze cattle. It's between two mountains in a beautiful, fertile valley. And it could be that he thought, well, you know, I'll just settle down here. I think I can handle it. I think God's promised to take care of me. I don't know. I'm just guessing. All right? Well, anyway, it seemed to be a convenient place to settle. And so he halted on his pilgrimage and did not go back to Bethel for whatever reason for 10 years. 10 years elapsed. And here was this promise that he had made to God. And I can hardly believe that Jacob forgot that promise. I think you'll find it nagged at him. I think you'll find that's the reason why perhaps when he went back and forth to Hebron to visit his father, we don't have any record of his ever stopping there. And God finally had to say, Jacob, go back to Bethel. All right? Well, I'm not going to read this sordid account of what happens next. But he had teenage children. Teenage children at this point. And at least somewhere along the line as he was living there at Shechem, they became teenagers. I don't know if Dinah had any sisters or not, but she was a typical teenager. She wanted companionship. And I don't know, maybe she had gotten a little bit rebellious. Jacob didn't have the most ideal home to teach his children what moral purity was. He had four wives. It was a polygamous home, and we know that the family was sort of a dysfunctional family. Anyway, whatever the situation was, this girl was in no shape to do what she did. And she goes out, and of course, she's raped by Shechem. Whatever happened there. I don't know how consensual it may have been. But anyway, it does say of Shechem, if you go down to verse 19, and the young man deferred not to do the thing, and we'll talk about what that was, because he had delight in Jacob's daughter, and he was more honorable than all the house of his father. I don't think this boy thought he had done anything wrong, particularly. I think you'll find that was a way of life, what happened, what he did to Dinah, was just what young men did. And here comes this girl. She's a foreigner. She's a novelty. And he does what he sees in his society. But there is one thing about Shechem that is honorable. And that is, he didn't then toss her off and go for the next one. He said, I love this girl. I want to marry this girl. I'm willing to pay whatever. I'm willing to do whatever. And took her into his house and I think treated her well. And so, in that respect, he was more honorable probably than anybody else in his society. You have to give him credit for that. Well, anyway. then, his father goes to negotiate. And to show you what kind of danger Jacob had put himself in. Look what almost happened here. Verse 8. And Hamor communed with them, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longeth for your daughter. I pray you give her him to wife. And make ye marriages with us. Ooh. And give your daughters unto us. And take our daughters unto you. Now we know down to the whole history of Israel that was a no-no. And this would have been a total disaster. In fact, I think God allowed to happen what happened, as terrible as it was, so that this didn't happen. And the land shall be before you, dwell and trade ye therein, and get you possessions therein. And Shechem said unto her father and unto her brethren. Now they show up at this point. By the way, Jacob, another evidence that there was something wrong here. we don't find Jacob doing anything about any of this. It says he held his peace till the brethren came. And then after they did what they did, then he sort of lamented. But you don't see Jacob being proactive with his family and in taking care of this situation. This is unusual for Jacob. Jacob's a man of action. He gets things lined up to meet Esau, and he does this, and he does that. And I mean, he's a man of, and all of a sudden, Jacob's passive. Through this whole passage, doing nothing. It could be that if Jacob had been proactive after this happened, I don't know what he would have done, but if he had tried to bring some sort of resolution or resolving of this whole thing, it could be that what the brothers did would never have happened. If he had picked up and left, maybe it wouldn't have happened. But Jacob's just sort of passive here. To me, it's pretty obvious looking at the passage that he wasn't where he was here. And he wasn't where he was here. So there's an interlude here. And I want us to be sobered by what happens when we step out of the place of blessing. I mean, we see this happening all around us. We see things happening in families. We see things happening in churches. We see... The fact of the matter is, people get out of the place of blessing. They may be fine Christian people, like Jacob was a fine godly man. But godly people can get out of the place of blessing, and it gets pretty bad. All right? So anyway, let's continue. And the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor his father deceitfully and said, because he hath defiled Dinah our sister. And they said unto them, we cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one that is uncircumcised, for that were reproach unto us. And here these boys, now they did it deceitfully, they offer the mark of the covenant to these heathen people. This whole passage is wrong. I mean, from beginning to end, the behavior of Shechem, the behavior of the boys, the behavior of Jacob. I mean, something, this is, if you want a chapter in the Bible that shows what happens when you miss the blessing, this is a good one. Anyway, so they say, if you'll be circumcised, and of course you know what happened, they went and they convinced the whole village or the whole city to do that, and then when they weren't in any shape to fight, it only took two boys, they were her sisters, by Leah, Simeon and Levi. They, of course, take a sword. They kill everybody in the city except the women and the children. And then their brothers come and they spoil this city and carry all the spoil away. And even then, Jacob says, and Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, ye have troubled me to make me to stink among the inhabitants of the land. He doesn't say, you boys are wrong. He doesn't. I mean, he's basically saying that, but he's still sort of passive. He's just complaining. And I being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house. And they said, should he deal with our sisters, with a harlot? And Jacob doesn't seem to be taking hold of this very well. Okay, so this evil proceeded logically from his prolonged partnership with this heathen community that he had settled down in. And it ended up with rape, treachery, massacre. It just is an ugly picture. And so the word this morning is, don't miss the blessing. Stay in the place of blessing. Because outside of that place, it's pretty fearsome and pretty scary. All right. Well, that was Jacob's wake-up call. And in the middle of the whole thing, God says unto Jacob, verse chapter 35, arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there. That's where I want you to dwell. He never told him to dwell at Shechem in the first place. That seems to have been Jacob's decision. Dwell there and make there an altar unto God. Now, if you notice, if you go back to verse 20 of chapter 33, he erected an altar there at Shechem. I think Jacob was saying, I made this promise I would erect an altar and Bethel would be the house of God. Well, I'll build an altar here. I don't know what he had in mind, but he actually called it El Elohi Israel. Sort of reminiscent of the name of Bethel. And God says, no, Jacob. Not there, here. Go to Bethel, and there you build your altar. Not at Shechem. All right? And let's continue reading. Then Jacob said to his household, we have gathered up too much heathenism. We need to make a break. We need a, shall we call it a revival? We're going to get rid of all the junk, all the earrings that have inscriptions to these heathen gods that you brought along from Laban's place or from Shechem. Purify yourselves, put on new clothes, get rid of the idols. Let's read it. Then Jacob said unto his house, I wanted to note also in verse 1, and make there an altar unto the Lord that appeared unto thee when thou fleddest from the face of Esau thy brother. Clear reference to what Jacob had promised to do and had avoided doing up until now. Then Jacob said unto his household, and to all that were with him, put away the strange gods that are among you, and be clean, and change your garments, and let us arise and go up to Bethel. And I will make there an altar unto God, who answered me in the day of my distress, and was with me in the way which I went. And they did that, and they buried them all under an oak tree. And they journeyed, and the terror of God, see, now he had, this word had gone out, I'm sure, about this massacre, and all these people were just like Jacob said, were angry, and who knows what was going to happen. But that when Jacob went back to Bethel, God's protection again came upon him, like he didn't have from those Canaanites. The terror of God was upon the cities that were round about them. They did not pursue after the sons of Jacob. And so he came to Luz, which is in the land of Canaan, that is Bethel, he and all the people that were with him. And he built there an altar and called the place El Bethel, which is the God of the God of Bethel. Because there God appeared unto him when he fled from the face of his brother. But Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died. And that would have been someone that Jacob would have known from the time he was a child, because Rebekah brought that nurse when she came to Isaac. So this is an old woman that had been with the family all those years. And now she finally dies, and she's with Jacob. And I told you, that's, to me, that's an evidence that he'd had some sort of contact with where his father lived, with this nurse. And she was buried beneath Bethel under an oak, and the name of it was called Alon Bakus. And so now the blessing is restored. We have the blessing that he had received when he fled from Esau, his brother, plus a little bit added to it. I mean, each time God gives this blessing, he adds a little more to it. And that's an encouraging thing, too. That God's blessing keeps getting larger and larger and larger. It never diminishes. And God said unto him, I am the God, I am God Almighty. That's the first time he said that to Jacob. He had said that to Abraham. I am God Almighty. El Shaddai. Shad means breast. I am the God upon whose breast you can lean, and I will take care of everything. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall be of thee, and kings shall come out of thy loins. There's the added promise. I mean, this is really a grandiose promise. And the land which I gave to Abraham and Isaac, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed after thee will I give the land. And the Lord went up from him in the place where he talked with him. And Jacob set up the pillar. That seems to be Jacob's natural response. He likes to set up pillars and pour oil on them as a physical representation of his consecration. And he poured a drink offering thereon and poured oil thereon. And Jacob called the name of the place where God spake with him, Bethel. And then we find that Rachel dies near Bethlehem. And when the infants were put to death, it talked about the travail of Rachel. Well, that's exactly what had happened at this spot. David was born there later. Christ was born there later. This becomes a very significant spot near Ephrata, Bethlehem. And verse 22, and it came to pass when Israel dwelt in the land that Reuben committed incest with his mother. And it doesn't make much comment on that there again. There's not much said about what Isaac's response was, but he did remember it. If you remember later on, whenever he calls his sons before him to give them his blessing there in Egypt, he reminds him. And this boy lost his birthright. He was the oldest son. He should have had the birthright, but he lost it because of that deed. Verse 27, we have the listing of the 12 tribes. And then in verse 27, or the 11 tribes, 12, Benjamin is born. 27, and Jacob came unto Isaac his father in Mamre, unto the city of Abraham, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac sojourned. So he finally is home. And the days of Isaac were 104 score years, which means if you calculate, he was still living when Joseph was sold into slavery. So Isaac had lived, and that's going to become significant when we get to Joseph's story. And Isaac gave up the ghost and died. He was gathered unto his people, being old and full of days, and Esau and Jacob buried him. So we have the blessing sought. God richly poured it out upon him. And then we have the blessing received. He has victory over his brother Esau and is reunited with him. We have the blessing forfeited when he comes to Shechem. We have it restored when he goes to Bethel. And now we have the blessing diverted. Esau so desperately wanted the blessing. And I think Esau got what he wanted. If you read in this next passage, which we're not going to read, I mean, I think there's something like 14 dukes come out of him. Like I said, he goes down to Edom. He finally realizes that there's not enough pasture for their flocks up here. So he completely, wait a minute, I put that at the wrong place. I didn't even get it on the map. Okay. Anyway, so he leaves and goes down here and actually conquers that territory before Israel had any land at all and prospered there and had dukes and kings and, you can read it, scads of descendants. His family grew a lot faster than what Jacob's did, and he was able to realize material blessings far beyond anything that Israel was experiencing for many hundreds of years. In fact, when they were really at their glory peak down here, this bunch was down here in Egypt in slavery. And so you'd have looked on and you'd have said, well, Esau's the one that got the blessing. Esau's the one that got the blessing, but no, he didn't. Esau doesn't exist after a little while. And finally, we do find him there ruling Palestine during the time of Christ, and then he passes out of existence. But God's kingdom and Jacob's promise continues to go on. So the question is this. Do you miss the blessing? Or do you stay exactly where God wants you to stay? That's the question. Esau completely rejected the blessing. He tried to get it back. He couldn't get it back. Jacob sidestepped God's blessing and experienced all of this sorrow. But Jacob knew how to get back in the place of blessing. And I guess the question I'm asking is, if you're not in the place of blessing, you need to go back to Bethel. Don't miss the blessing. Let's turn to number 230 and sing the rest of the verses of that song. A part of Esau's descendants were the Amalekites, who were bitter enemies of God's people. And the total effect of Esau was not positive. The total effect of Jacob was very positive. So let's sing verses 2, 3, and 4.
Fear not, I am with thee, oh, be not dismayed, for I am thy God and will still give thee aid. I'll strengthen thee, help thee, and cause thee to stand upheld by thy righteous omnipotent hand, upheld by my righteous omnipotent hand. When through the deep waters I call thee to go, the rivers of sorrow shall not overflow. For I will be with thee, thy troubles to bless, and sanctify to thee thy deepest distress, and sanctify to thee thy deepest distress.
Now notice the fivefold reassurance.
The soul that on Jesus hath leaned for repose, I will not desert to his foes. That soul, though all hell should endeavor to shake, I'll never, no, never, no, never forsake. I'll never, no, never, no, never forsake.
That's the encouraging word. That even though we may have our natural fears like Jacob, and even though we may step out of his blessing, he does not forsake us. He does not say a judgmental word. You don't find any place where God makes a judgmental statement about Jacob. He finally just says, go up to Bethel. He corrects the way and treats him tenderly as a father and just keeps guiding him. Any person who wants that place of blessing can have it despite all his mistakes and all of his fears. And that's the blessing. Does somebody have a comment you'd like to make?